From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why is it that many women see baring their midriffs, piercing their navels, or stripping as empowering? Why are stereotypes of female sexuality that feminists tried to banish now seen as good for women? These are some of the questions Aria Levy asks in her book, Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Levy. Also, the great band The Microscopic Septet has gotten back together for a series of reunion concerts, and they've reissued their albums on CD. The CDs include the theme they recorded for Fresh Air and a couple of the alternate themes they did for us. We'll listen back to some of their music with The Microscopic Septet's Jill Forrester and Philip Johnston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ariel Levy, is trying to figure out why a tawdry, tardy, cartoon-like version of female sexuality has become so ubiquitous. Why movie stars who talk about strong women and empowerment dress, quote, like massage parlor geishas and dominatrixes. And why some of her female friends started going to strip clubs and described the experience as liberating and rebellious. Levy considers these and other related questions in her book Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture, which has recently come out in paperback. Levy is a contributing editor at New York Magazine, where she writes about sexuality, culture, and gender politics. Ariel Levy, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with just like a basic definition of what do you mean by raunch culture?
Well, it's sort of this term I made up to describe what I see as the spread of the values and aesthetics of a red light district into mainstream culture. So I just was noticing, maybe 5 or 6 years ago before I wrote this book, that it was like every time I left the house, I would see a teenage girl with the Playboy bunny on her T-shirt. And every time I turned on the television, it felt like no matter what time it was or what channel I had the things tuned to, there was always a show on about strippers. And it struck me that as a culture, we had sort of become like one big lap dance club.
And what do you mean by female chauvinist pigs?
Well, the titles, it's obviously a play on the old concept of a male chauvinist pig. So if male chauvinist pigs were guys who treated women like pieces of meat, then female chauvinist pigs are women who make sex objects of other women and of themselves.
Are there certain celebrities who you think epitomize the phenomenon that you're talking about?
The women who really epitomize this are sex workers, are like Jenna Jameson, who's the top-selling adult film star on planet Earth. And she had this memoir a few years ago that was on the bestseller list. And to me, what was so interesting about this, about having somebody who was getting paid to have sex be the sort of spokesperson supposedly for sexual liberation, this is a woman like any other sex worker whose job it is to fake lust. So I just felt there was something peculiar about us, women in America thinking that we were going to imitate an imitation of female sexual pleasure and power as embodied by a sex worker and thereby become in touch with ourselves sexually.
In the language of 60s feminism, dressing in a very kind of sexually available way to please men was considered objectification. The result of men seeing your body as a sexual object and you responding by dressing in a sexually mm-hmm. objectified way. But now a lot of women will tell you, no, that's post-feminism. Now, because feminism's victories, so many of them have been achieved and we don't really have to worry about that anymore, we're free to dress as sexually as we want to and we're doing it ourselves. Nobody's objectifying us. That's us choosing to do this. So it's liberating. It's power. What's your answer to that?
I guess to me, it was sort of like one of these things where everybody was nodding along saying, yes, of course, strippers equal feminism, porn stars equal empowerment. And at some point, it was like the emperor has no clothes. Like, I don't understand why all these things suddenly mean the opposite of what feminists told us they meant. It's supposed to be this ironic joke, but at some point, I think the joke's on us. If we're all looking up to women who aren't actually having sex because they want to. In other words, I think if we're going to have sexual role models as women, it ought to be the women who get the most pleasure from sex, not the women who get paid the most to do it.
But what about the idea that this is post-feminist? This is self-empowerment. Men aren't making me dress this way. I'm choosing to do it myself. It's powerful to be proud of my body and reveal it.
Yeah, I think the thing about it is that certainly I think that it's fantastic that women have options, that women have, more choices, and that the feminist movement did make so much, just an enormous amount of progress in a stunning, extremely short period of time. I'm constantly, when I was doing this research, constantly struck by all the things that have happened that I take for granted. Just when they started this, the second wave of the feminist movement, women, of course, couldn't get a checking account without a signature from their husband or father, and there was no such thing as contraception for unmarried women legally, and of course there was no such thing as abortion. So it's amazing what's happened, and it's great that women have more choices. But I think in terms of the argument that exhibitionism is automatically some kind of expression of power. I don't necessarily buy that. An example of how it can mean something else, I went on spring break with a group called Girls Gone Wild. And for anybody who's not familiar with them, essentially it's this company based around sending cameramen to, you know, spring break destinations or sort of college keg parties. And these guys, I mean, I saw them do it. They walk around with a hat that says Girls Gone Wild or T-shirt and their cameras, and women just go up to them, young women just go up to them and for free flash their breasts or make out with each other, or basically put on a sort of amateur softcore porn show. And then, you know, the footage is sold and these women never make a penny off it. And it's when I would interview these girls and say, okay, so you're not getting paid. Why'd you do this? I heard several versions, you know, of the same thing. One young woman said to me, well, you know, it's like a reflex. And another young woman said to me, the only way I could see somebody, this was a girl who had simulated masturbation for their cameras at a bar. She said, well, the only way I could see somebody not doing this is if she were considering a career in politics, which I thought was sort of funny. I mean, it struck me that there was just this sense that, of course, this is what a woman would do. It was sort of part of the job of being female, was to put on these kinds of shows. And, of course, these young women aren't creating this. I mean, they're mirroring back the culture they see around them. And so, sure, it's great, hypothetically, that we're free to do this. But I think when something becomes ubiquitous like this, when a trend becomes this intense, it stops looking like an option and starts looking more like an obligation to me.
Mm-hmm. Let me quote you from your book, Female Chauvinist Pigs. You write that you think this phenomenon isn't about liberation. You think it's essentially commercial. And you say, this isn't free love. Raunch culture isn't about opening our minds to the possibilities and mysteries of sexuality. It's about endlessly reiterating one particular and one particularly commercial shorthand for sexiness. In what way do you see this phenomenon as being commercial?
Well, I mean, I think that there's this sense in which sexuality, you know, like the most thrilling and complicated and mysterious thing that we have, or one of them, to play with as humans, you know, we've sort of reduced it down to, you know, implants, polyester underpants, Brazilian bikini waxes, all these things that can be bought and sold. And it strikes me that once you make sex not about weird, complicated things, and you make it about that stuff, then it's just another thing to buy and sell. And I see that a lot, you know, in terms of on television and reality shows, for example. I mean, it's almost as if we can't summon the concept of sexy without seeing those things. Like, we need to see something that looks like Paris Hilton to even conjure the concept of sexiness.
You know, in the 60s, during the feminist movement, there was a sense that things like Playboy, it was part of this like male patriarchal culture, that men mm-hmm. were controlling culture and they were objectifying women for commercial reasons or for their own sexual pleasure. But you point out in your book that a lot of the men's sex magazines and some of the more sexual TV shows which show, you know, women bearing their breasts and whatever, are actually edited or produced by women. And you interviewed mm-hmm. several of those women. What did you want to know? What did they tell you?
Well, I wanted to know, you know, how they thought about this, whether it was something they were conflicted about or you know, whether it was something they even thought about. And I think the answers really ranged. But there was one woman who was a co-executive producer of The Man Show. And she said to me, you know, it's always women have always had to make men feel comfortable with where we're at. And if you can show them that you're one of the guys, it's good. I mean, and, you know, essentially it's just another way of saying if you can't beat them, join them. I mean, it's the same old idea. And it makes sense. I mean, it's like that old thing of, you know, Ginger Rogers had to do everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in heels. I think there's plenty of women, you know, editors at magazines or producers in television shows or, you know, any number of things where they feel that in order to not be seen as a prissy little woman, they better, you know, not object to any level of raunch. They better make it seem like they're the first to embrace it.
You know, when you were mentioning spending a week with Girls Gone Wild, and one of the things that the young women would do for this was to make out with each other.
Uh-huh.
Is part of this kind of raunch culture doing lesbian kind of things, not because you're a lesbian, but because it's cool or because it's a turn on for men?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, these high school kids in Oakland, California were telling me how that, you know, at the school dances, they're always sort of making out with each other and giving the guys lap dances. I mean, which if I try to imagine that happening at my high school dance, I just like it's like we were, oh, God, we were so much more hung up in some ways. Although, I mean, you know, I don't think that what's happening, back to this idea of this isn't free love, I don't think what's happening is that these kids are just sort of like wildly sensuous and, you know, completely, you know, just letting their passion sort of set free. Again, I think it's more about performance. And when I interviewed these kids, I mean, they weren't using the lexicon of sort of smoldering pleasure. They were talking about shows. They were talking about, well, I've seen this, you know, on so-and-so's MySpace page, or I've seen this on MTV. I mean, this is what you're supposed to do. And yeah, I absolutely think that you know, the business of girls making out. I mean, it's like a porn tableau. But, I mean, all these kids, of course, will be really fast to tell you, well, I'm not bisexual or anything like that. I mean, there's still – I don't think it means that they're just completely comfortable with that idea.
So why did they tell you they do it?
They want to fit in. And, I mean, they – think about Paris Hilton. I mean, you know, here's this young woman who was sort of just another bold-faced name until this amateur sex tape came out, which is what rocketed her into, you know, mega stardom. I mean, it's such a contrast when you think about how recently it was that the revelation that a woman had appeared in any kind of pornography would have ruined her career. I mean, you think about Vanessa Williams having her crown taken away once they found out these pictures of her kissing another woman. And she was able to make this comeback as a singer, but then porn was something you had to make a comeback from. Now, porn is itself the thing that makes you famous.
My guest is Aria Levy, author of the book Female Chauvinist Pigs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Aria Levy, author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. It recently came out in paperback. So what was your understanding of feminism when you were coming of age? And I should mention here that, you, as you describe in your book, your mother is a shiatsu masseuse who attended weekly women's consciousness-raising groups for 24 years and didn't own any makeup. And your father has been a consultant to Planned Parenthood, the National Abortion Rights.
National Abortion Rights Action League.
Action League, yes. And now. So what kind of understanding of feminism were you brought up with, and what did it mean to you?
I was very impassioned about it. I mean, I remember being, you know, in like sixth grade or something and sort of standing on my soapbox and giving spiels about this stuff. I mean, I always felt very strongly about it, and I always felt irked by the way I experienced this pressure for girls to be quieter and to sort of, you know, take up less space than boys. I mean, as a child, that, you know, as a very verbal, loud child, I always thought that that was an outrageous thing, that boys were sort of encouraged to talk a lot and that people were always telling me to be quiet. So, I mean, I was always very self-righteous about it, I think. And I mean, I think to both my parents' credit, particularly to my dad's credit, I think I had the great good fortune of having a father who really always pressured me to be funny and pressured me to be smart and didn't ever talk about the way I looked one way or the other. And I think that's a great thing. I think that's a great gift for a dad to give his daughter.
Now, one thing you write in your book is that raunch culture feels the most alien to aging hippies like my parents, but it's actually also a repercussion of the forces they set in motion. Mm-hmm. In what way do you see raunch culture as being a repercussion of 60s hippie culture or 60s feminist culture?
Well, I mean, I think on the most simplistic level, if you sort of reduce, you know, the sexual liberation movement and the women's liberation movement to their most commercial sort of base level, you can see traces of that in raunch culture. I mean, it's a perversion of what those movements were supposed to stand for, but you can sort of see where they have some history in that. But I think in a more direct way, what you see young women doing is you know, nobody wants to turn into their mother, right? So there's this generational rebellion where these young women, you know, whether their mothers were radical feminists or evangelical Christians, either way, they know that on some level, flashing their breasts for girls gone wild, they're infuriating their moms and defining themselves in a very different way.
I'm going to quote you again. You write, many of the conflicts between the women's liberation movement and the sexual revolution, and many of the conflicts within the women's liberation movement, remain unresolved. What we are seeing today is the residue of that confusion. Would you elaborate on that?
Yes, of course. What most members of the women's liberation movement have said to me, you know, is that they consider the last gasp of radical feminism to have been the so-called porn wars in the 80s, which of course posited so-called pro-sex feminists against anti-porn feminists. And of course, everybody thought they were being pro-sex. You know, the anti-porn feminists thought that by trying to rid the world of degrading images, what they felt were degrading images of women, they were making room for a more liberated and satisfying, you know, sexual culture. And of course, the pro-sex feminists thought that if feminism was about freedom, then women should have the freedom to make pornography or appear in pornography. And I think that, you know, nobody could ever resolve that. And I think that we're still working on that. But what's been interesting to me when I interviewed women who called themselves pro-sex feminists, like, for example, the feminist pornographer, Candida Royale, you know, a lot of them said to me, it's one thing to be trying to make room for sort of different images of female sexuality and giving women room for all this kind of experimentation. But what you see with raunch culture, the sort of uniformity of it, the sort of the way that there's only one very rigid model of female sexuality that's allowed to come out, this sort of lusty, busty exhibitionist with big fake breasts and big blonde hair and long fingernails who's spinning around a pole. That's not what they had in mind.
Well, like you said before, nobody wants to grow up to be their mother. Everybody wants to kind of separate and create her own identity. And I'm wondering if there were things that turned you off about your mother's vision of what feminism was that you rebelled against.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's generational rebellion or just a sort of coincidence of personalities, but it's like vanity skipped a generation in my family. No, it's true. My mother's mother, my grandmother, was a beautician, and she loved jewelry and makeup and clothes and all the rest of it. And my mother just is totally uninterested in all that stuff. I think she thinks it's boring and shallow. And I love that stuff. I mean, it just, you know, I'm very interested in fashion, and I have a very sort of traditionally feminine self-presentation. And I don't, you know, I don't know what that's about. I don't know if that's a rebellion or just a sort of glitch of personality. And but it's certainly a difference between my mother and I.
Did you ever go through a period of wanting to deny yourself that, thinking that, you know, it was superficial?
Well, absolutely. I mean, when I was in college, I mean, Wesleyan was this quite radical place, and you're sort of challenging everything, questioning everything. And like a lot of other college girls, I mean, I sort of went through this period where I thought, what am I shaving my legs for? This is a ridiculous use of time. And the thing is, it is a ridiculous use of time, you know. And I think that, I mean, femininity, I mean, Susan Brownmiller wrote a feminist classic, a fantastic book called Femininity, exploring, you know, the pleasures and absurdities of all these rituals. And it's hard to know, you know, where to begin and where to end with this stuff. I mean, to me, in my book and in my life, I mean, the distinction I draw is sort of between the things that give you pleasure and the things that absolutely don't. For example, cosmetic surgery is something – I wrote an article for Vogue magazine a few years ago about women who had died having voluntary cosmetic surgery, you know, facelifts essentially. There were several women who died a few years ago having facelifts. I mean, to me, it's just stunning. You know, the number of breast implants that happen in this country has gone up 700% in the last 10 years. And I think it's very saddening that people are willing to go through that much pain and to risk their lives for an aesthetic. I think, you know, it's like, it's one thing to wear a pair of shoes that hurt a little. It's another to put yourself in actual physical danger, to me.
What is your vision of feminism now? I imagine you'd describe it as being somewhat different from your mother's vision of feminism.
Well, you know, the thing is, I mean, I think that the word itself, of course, has famously fallen out of favor with my generation and the generations younger than I am. I'm 32. I don't think that's so surprising or so problematic. You know, I mean, nobody's walking around calling themselves yippies anymore either, you know. So, I mean, I just think that the various names for revolutionary movements for social change that were, you know, comfortable and popular in the 60s and 70s, that, you know, they're just not, they just don't fit necessarily now. And I mean, I think that, you know, there's no such thing as a unified women's movement right now. I think it's fragmented, and I think people are doing lots of important things. And I think that, you know, the ongoing struggle for reproductive rights is crucial. And I think that, I mean, people are doing so much important work. I just don't think it's got a sort of solid, unified center.
Aria Levy is the author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. It recently came out in paperback. Levy will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of A Military Miscellany, important, uncommon, and sometimes forgotten facts and stories from America's military history, by Thomas Ayers. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's not exactly the Beatles reuniting, but we're pretty excited that the Microscopic Septet has gotten back together for a reunion tour, and they've re-released their albums on CD. They recorded the Fresh Air theme, and we feature a lot of their music on our show. Coming up, we talk with Philip Johnston and Joel Forrester of the Micros, and we continue our conversation with Aria Levy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Aria Levy, author of the book Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. She describes female chauvinist pigs as women who make sex objects of other women and of themselves, and who see it as empowering to imitate porn stars and strippers. She wonders why sexual stereotypes that feminists rejected are now seen as liberating. You see raunch culture in part as a reaction against political correctness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What kind of political correctness do you feel like you were exposed to and that you understand a reaction to?
Oh, gosh. Well, Wesleyan, I mean, it was so insane. When I was in school, I mean, it was the time also, you know, the early 90s. People were just going wild with this stuff and the place also. But, I mean, I think that it was like you had to trip over yourself to say anything because you had to constantly be identifying your own particular location as a thinker or speaker. So, you know, if you're saying anything, you got to make sure you're saying, okay, but I'm a Jewish white woman from this economic bracket, and, you know, on and on and on. And I mean, that's another problem with the language. I think that's one of the reasons people get prickly about saying, well, I'm a feminist, or as a feminist, I think that this, that, or the other. It's like that only tells you one thing. You also want to know 14 million other things about the person to sort of identify their point of view. And I think that, you know, as a reaction, as a rebellion against that PC tightness that was big in the late 80s and early 90s, there's this freewheeling quality to Raunch, this kind of like throw your hands up in there and shrug it all off and just, you know, suddenly you don't have to say women, you can say chick. You don't have to say African-American, you can say black, or you can say things that are even, you know, less okay than that. I mean, I think you see that, you know, with the rise of hip-hop, too. I mean, this just sort of like casting off of any idea of political correctness. So, I mean, I think that that's very attractive to a lot of people in their 30s and 20s. And in the teens, I mean, they have nothing to react against. I think they never lived in a time when bitches and hoes wasn't part of the lexicon.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up hip-hop. Is the phenomenon that you're talking about, do you see that as a white phenomenon? Or
no.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't. I mean, I think, you know, all you have to do is, like, watch almost any hip-hop video and you know, just see, like, a phalanx of young women who are almost naked with breast implants, you know, using their body parts to, like, wax a car while a rapper goes at it and does his thing in front of them. I mean, so the man is the artist and is the speaker, and so much more often than not, the women are sort of hood ornaments. I mean, that's completely the Raunch culture aesthetic and ethos.
Do you think that there will soon be a new generation of teenagers and young women who react against Raunch culture? Just as, I mean, right before Raunch culture, there was so much like grunge culture among teenagers, wearing just like baggy flannel shirts and hooded sweatshirts and really covering themselves up.
Well, I don't know. I'm always surprised by the direction fashion goes in. But, I mean, I do want to point out, again, this split between appearance and behavior. I think there's still a lot of emphasis on purity and virginity, you know. And some of the early stars of Raunch culture, for example, were Jessica Simpson and Britney Spears. And when they first became popular, it was like, you know, they were half naked. They were these national pastimes with drooling over these girls. But they had to tell us constantly in their music that sex was something they sang about, not something they engaged in. I mean, I still think that there's this real pressure to be a virgin even while you look like a whore. It's like we want all our sort of iconic female roles in one. And I think, you know, not unrelated is the fact that we keep pumping billions of dollars into abstinence-only education, which tells these young people essentially just say no to sex until you're married. And we do that despite the fact that there's never been a single study to show that this works. And, of course, the United States has woefully high levels of, you know, teen pregnancy and STD spread. So I think it's like there's an actual anxiety about sexuality paired with a sort of endless appetite for hotness.
So you see the culture heading in two directions, two opposite directions, or seemingly opposite directions at the same time. Is there any way of reconciling that?
Well, I mean, I just think that if young people are going to exist in this, the only world that there is, you know, I think that they need to be armed with more information than the concept just say no, which is what they're taught in abstinence-only education classes. And I think it's just so bizarre that we keep pumping money into those programs when there's never been a single study to show that they work. And when, you know, the United States has much, much worse rates of teen pregnancy and teen STDs than other nations of comparable privilege.
Well, Ariel Levy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ariel Levy is the author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. It recently came out in paperback. Coming up, a great band from the 80s and early 90s reunites for a tour. We talk with Philip Johnston and Joel Forrester of the Microscopic Septet. We play a lot of their music on our show. This is Fresh Air. Yeah. You probably recognize this as the theme music that we always use to begin our show. We're playing it here to introduce our next guest. When we needed a new theme about 15 years ago, we went to a band that we loved, the Microscopic Septet. They never had a lot of commercial success, but they had a devoted following. Back in 1988, the music critic Francis Davis wrote, "Posterity is going to remember the Microscopic Septet as one of the best bands of the 1980s. Not long after our theme was recorded, the Micros broke up. But the good news is they've gotten back together for a series of reunion concerts in several cities, including New York and Philadelphia, and they've just reissued all four of their albums on two double CDs, Seven Men in Neckties and Surrealistic Swing. My guests are the band's co-founders and main composers, soprano saxophonist Philip Johnston and pianist Joel Forrester. The Micros not only play our theme music, we also feature a lot of their recordings in between segments. Here's one that regular Fresh Air listeners will recognize, Joel Forrester's Off Color. Johnston, Joel Forrester, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on these reunion concerts and the reissue CDs. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It's great to be here.
Boy, isn't it?
Let's go back to kind of the beginning for a second and talk about how you saw the band and what you thought its place was in jazz in the 80s. Like, maybe you could describe how you, the leaders of the band, envisioned the sound.
I think the basic reasons for starting the band were twofold. One, I wanted to do something of my own music that inculcated the influences of the different types of music that I was enthusiastic about, because whatever type of music I was playing, I always wanted to, that I was listening to and enjoying, I always wanted to play it. So I was really into jazz from the 20s and 30s. I was really into free jazz. I was really into stuff like Charles Mingus and Steve Lacy and Herbie Nichols and Duke Ellington, very much an influence, the John Kirby Sextet, people like that. So I wanted to put those, and also the Art Ensemble of Chicago, Anthony Braxton, I wanted to put all those things together because that's what was going on in my head. And then there was a bunch of great musicians who I was playing with in different bands, and I thought, wouldn't it be great for us all to do something together?
Joe, what would you want to add to that about the sound of the Micros?
Well, I would say that the sound comes from the odd personalities of the people involved, Terry. And I loved the fact that this seemed to be a band which had an ongoing commitment to playing new music on a regular basis. We rehearsed like mad, and when we played gigs, we'd choose those gigs where we could play three sets, play long, long into the night. And I think our listeners got caught up in the fact that we were doing something that was just a little bit different.
One of the things that Micros fans like myself really love about the band is that you always have a sense of humor in the music. It's just like fun and witty. And did the humor ever get you into trouble, though, at the same time?
Well, I think some people had a problem with it. I remember there's an episode in particular where we played at the JVC Jazz Festival, and one reviewer wrote about us that while he admired the music from a technical point of view and a musical point of view, The humor he found very off-putting because he said he didn't understand whether we were making fun of ourselves or the music or our audience, to which I enthusiastically respond, all three. For some reason, people, especially people in the press, found that to be kind of puzzling. But what we were doing was partially reacting against the seriousness and the self-importance that jazz had been acquiring as it moved from being a popular music to an art music. That was part of its growing form. But for us, coming up in the generation in the 60s and early 70s that we did, we rejected that. It was part of, I think, everything that was going on. And also, I think there's the influence, for me at least, of the music that I loved so much, the jazz of the 20s and 30s, people like Don Redman. I mean, that music was very humorous, as well as having many other aspects that I related to, mystery and drama and so on. And then music like the Art Ensemble of Chicago also expressed a lot of humor. So putting those together, those were just things that I related to about it.
But you know, Philip, you and I have both become serious and self-important now, so
exactly.
It should be easy for us to be ridiculous once again.
Well, there was that, and then it's just the particular personalities of the people in the band. I mean, enough cannot be said about the qualities of individuality that each unique musician in the Microscopic Septet brought to the music. And I remember reading about the Ellington Reed section, that one of the things about it that was different from all the other bands was that everybody had a very distinct style of playing the saxophone. They had different vibrato and so on, and the other bands at the time tried to play more similar to get a blend, but the Ellington band, they just played the way they played. Well, in the Microscopic Septet, you can't find people who play more differently than each other.
Well, I would like to ask you each to choose a track that you're kind of happy to hear again and you're glad is on CD and that you'd like to play for us. So Joel, let's start with you.
I guess I would choose Second Avenue as the pick I'd like to hear.
And tell me why.
Well, Second Avenue actually is a tune from my earliest days in New York in the early 70s, if such a thing is possible, before Philip Johnston and I met. And it's probably one of the first tunes that he and I got together, just playing as a duo. It sums up a certain feeling about a street that our lives sort of clustered around for many years.
Okay, so this is Second Avenue, and this is from the Live in Concert CD on the new Microscopic Septet reissue, Seven Men in Neckties. Microscopic Septet. The track is called Second Avenue. It was composed by Joel Forrester, and along with Joel in the studio is Philip Johnston of the Microscopic Septet. And Philip, now I'm going to ask you to choose something and tell us why you're choosing it.
Well, I would choose Chinese Twilight Zone because it's a tune. I guess at that age, I really had a tremendous urgency and compulsion to put everything that I knew into a tune. And Chinese Twilight Zone is a tune that's just crammed full of different stuff. And I just wanted to show how inside me all the different types of music connected. And I had to just shove it all into one tune. As I got older, I think I started separating things out and concentrating on a certain idea for a tune, for example, and developing it further. I learned more about development and studying composition further. But at that time of life, like many people in their 20s. I just wanted to tell people everything that I knew and loved and was excited about.
So what have you crammed into this?
Well, you name it. It's got everything but the kitchen sink. It's got swing. It's got Latin. It's got rock and roll. It's got an element of minimalism, cartoon music. Gee, I can't even remember what all. Just a lot of stuff. It changes constantly through the whole tune and keeps going to different places.
So this is Chinese Twilight Zone, composed by Philip Johnston from the new Microscopic Septet reissue, Seven Men in Neckties. That's Philip Johnston's composition, Chinese Twilight Zone, from the new Microscopic Septet double reissue, which is called Seven Men in Neckties. And the track we just heard was originally on the first Micros album, which was called Take the Z Train. Philip, you worked on putting this CD reissue together. What was it like for you to reimmerse yourself in your earliest recorded music?
Well, the biggest difficulty about it was just remembering things and finding materials. Like I think most musicians, I never listen to my own records unless I'm forced to for some reason. And to go back 20, 25 years and listen to stuff I hadn't thought about, it seems like it's by somebody else in a way, because my music has gone to a very different place since that time. But I was happy to hear I still liked it. It seemed very far away from what I do now.
My guests are Philip Johnston and Joel Forrester of the Microscopic Septet. They're reuniting for a concert tour and have reissued their albums on CD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Joel Forrester and Philip Johnston of the Microscopic Septet. The Micros are reuniting for a concert tour and have reissued their albums on CD. You know, as our listeners, I think, know, the Microscopic Septet plays the Fresh Air theme, and Joel, you compose the theme. And every so often, somebody comes up to me and says, I could swear that you used to play a major version, you know, a version of the theme, but in a major key instead of the customary minor key that we hear the theme in. And of course, they're right. There was a major key version of the theme, too. Joel, you had written two versions. You want to give us your version of the story of why there were two versions of the Fresh Air theme?
my version of the story, Terry, is that it's actually down to you that we play two versions. Now, isn't that true?
That's true.
Yes. You know, I mean, let's put credit where due, you know. I remember submitting to you a piece of very dense boogie-woogie and calling it Fresh Air, and you're telling me that no one could possibly read anything or say anything on top of it. So it was back to the drawing board. What I don't recall is whether I composed the so-called hard-boiled version or the happy version first. Do you remember?
I'm pretty sure it was the hard-boiled version first, the Marnicke version.
Okay.
And I remember really loving the theme and wondering at that point if it sounded almost too much like the theme for a detective series.
Yes, so. Too insistent, too much insinuation.
Mm-hmm. And that wasn't appropriate?
Well, it probably was appropriate. But
Terry
anyway,
Gross,
so,
Private Eye.
Yeah, that's exactly. It. So you wrote a major key version and called it The Happy Twin. In fact, why don't we just play it now? Well, I have to say, thank you, Joel, for writing the Happy Twin version of the theme, but I've always really liked the hard-boiled version, which is the one that we use.
And then there's many other versions that the listeners haven't heard. The ambivalent twin, the self-deprecating twin.
Philip's right about all that, of course.
And just in terms of the history of our theme, you know, the reason why we asked you guys to do the theme in the first place was because, well, Philip, like you were saying, you know, the band combines like the fun and the concise solos of jazz from the 20s and 30s with the more adventurous harmonies of contemporary jazz.
She puts it better than we have, Philip.
And that's exactly what we wanted for the theme. So we got a theme from you that really was kind of fun and lively. And what happened as soon as we were about to debut the theme, the Gulf War started, the first Gulf War in 91. And suddenly, like, the theme seemed all wrong for what was happening in the world and what we were covering on the show. So we actually held off on debuting that Fresh Air theme and played instead a different musical interlude that, Joel, you had written as music to be played in between interviews on the show. But it had a certain gravity to it that seemed appropriate as a theme, and Philip, that featured you on soprano saxophone.
Well, you know, Terry, that composition was scored like a hymn tune for the four saxes, sort of like the way Monk scored Abide With Me for the horns in an old Riverside LP. What we had was the four saxes playing this tune as if it were sort of a hymn tune, with Dickie Dworkin, our drummer, playing military-style drums behind it.
Well, let me actually play that Gulf War theme, so to speak, which is actually included on the second of the two microscopic septet reissues, and the second one is called Surrealistic Swing. The so-called Fresh Air Gulf War theme, and it's included on the microscopic septet's second of two reissues called Surrealistic Swing. I'd like to end with another track from the Micros reissue, And Philip, this is a piece that you wrote called A Strange Thought Entered My Head. Would you say something about it for us?
It's another tune which has crammed into it everything I know and goes to a lot of different places. And I think that was basically probably the number one aspect of my writing at the time. I was trying to explicate the connections that I was making through between different things, which seemed to me amazing. And I just wanted to tell everybody, hey, Kodo music is the same as blues guitar. Delta blues and Eastern European music was the same as 20s jazz, that there was a connection between all these things. And I wanted to put that into my music and express my discovery of it.
Well, thank you both again for being with us, and congratulations on the reunion.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for having us.
Mm.
Philip Johnston and Joel Forrester are reuniting with the five other members of the Microscopic Septet for a series of reunion concerts. Their albums have just been reissued on two double CDs, Men in Neckties and Surrealistic Swing. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carpenter Company, maker of bed pillows and other innovative products designed to help people sleep better. Z-score test and sleep tips are available at carpenter.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nicholas Blandford, the Beirut correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. His new book, Killing Mr. Lebanon, is about the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister, Rafik Hariri. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.